Tonight I'd like to pick up where we left off in the book of Isaiah. We left off in chapter 34. It's actually going to end one of the divisions of this book in regard to the pronouncements of judgments upon all these different various nations, but also the world. And this chapter 34, it really is a powerful chapter because it really is dealing with the second coming of Christ and the end of the world. And I'll show you what I mean. Beginning at verse 1, it says, "Draw near, O nations, to hear and listen, O people. Let the earth and all that it contains hear, and the world and all that springs from it. For the Lord's indignation is against all the nations, and his wrath is against all their armies. He has utterly destroyed them. He has given them over to slaughter. So their slain will be thrown out, and their corpses will give off their stench, and the mountains will be drenched with their blood." Before we go any further, these first three verses, they're just powerful. Isaiah predicted this like 750 years before the birth of Christ. And he's talking about the end of the world. He's talking about how he's going to gather all these nations down in Israel. And he's got an appointment with them. They have a destiny with meeting their Creator. So just back up that verse again. "Draw near, O nations, and hear, and listen, O peoples." And he's talking about everybody on earth. "Let the earth and all that contains hear, and the world and all that springs from it." So in other words, this isn't just a pronouncement of judgment against Israel, against any particular nation. This is against the entire world. It says, "For the Lord's indignation is against all nations." Again, as he said that in the first verse, and he said this in the second verse, it's all the nations, "and his wrath against all their armies, and has utterly destroyed them, has given them over to slaughter." Like, this has been predicted over and over again. For example, like in the book of Joel, when we went through that, in Joel chapter 3, God said this, "For behold, in those days and at that time I will restore the fortunes of Judah and Jerusalem, and I will gather all the nations and bring them down to the Valley of Jehoshaphat." The Valley of Jehoshaphat is another name for the Valley of Megiddo, or the Valley of Decision, or the Valley of Armageddon. "And then I will enter into judgment with them there on behalf of my people and my inheritance Israel." And he goes on to say, "Proclaim this among the nations, prepare a war, rouse the mighty men, let all the soldiers draw near and let them come up. Beat your plowshares into swords and your pruning hooks into spears, and let the weak say, 'I am a mighty man,' and hasten and come down all the surrounding nations and gather yourselves there. Bring down, O Lord, your mighty ones. Let the nations be aroused and come up to the Valley of Jehoshaphat, for there I will sit to judge all the surrounding nations. Put in the sickle, for the harvest is ripe. Come and tread the wine presses full. The vats overflow, for their wickedness is great. Multitudes, multitudes in the Valley of Decision, for the day of the Lord is near in the Valley of Decision." And it goes on to say, "The sun and the moon grow dark, and the stars lose their brightness. The Lord roars from Zion, and he utters his voice from Jerusalem. And the heavens and the earth tremble, but the Lord is a refuge for his people and a stronghold to the sons of Israel. Then you will know that I am the Lord your God, dwelling in Zion, my holy mountain. So Jerusalem will be holy, and strangers will not pass through it no more." Now, I just read that from the third chapter of Joel. It goes right hand in glove with what we're reading here in the 34th chapter of the book of Isaiah, but also in Zephaniah. Zephaniah talks about this end of the world when he says, "Near is the great day of the Lord, near and coming very quickly. Listen, the day of the Lord. In it the warrior cries out bitterly. A day of wrath is that day, a day of trouble and distress, a day of destruction and desolation, a day of darkness and gloom, a day of clouds and thick darkness, a day of trumpet and battle cry against the fortified cities and the high cornered towers. And I will bring distress on men so that they will walk like the blind, because they have sinned against the Lord, and their blood will be poured out like dust and their flesh like dung, and neither their silver nor their gold will be able to deliver them on the day of the Lord's wrath, and all the earth will be devoured in the fire of his jealousy, for he will make a complete end, indeed a terrifying one, of all the inhabitants of the earth." And you know, I could just go on and on in terms of what Isaiah is saying here in these first two verses of this chapter 34 of Isaiah. Basically, he's talking about the end of the world. And you go back to Revelation chapter 19. This is what John said. "I saw the heavens open, and behold, a white horse, and he who sat on it is called Faithful and True, and in righteousness he judges and wages war. In his eyes are a flame of fire, and on his head are many diadems. And he has a name written on him which no one knows except himself, and he is clothed with a robe that is dipped in blood, and his name is called the Word of God. And the armies which are in heaven, clothed in fine linen, white and clean, are following him on white horses. And out of his mouth comes a sharp two-edged sword, so with it he strikes down the nations, and he will rule them with a rod of iron. And he treads the winepress of the fierce wrath of God the Almighty. And on his robe and on his thighs has the name written, Lord of Lords and King of Kings. Now, what I'm saying here is that's what this is talking about. It's talking about the second coming of Christ, the end of the world, and how God is going to bring down all the nations down there in the Valley of Jehoshaphat, down there in Israel. Now, of course, not everybody in the world is going to be congregated down there, but what God is going to do is he's going to bring down basically an army from all the nations of the world. And you're going to have what we're told in Revelation, I think it's chapter 14, where John says that there's going to be 200 million men from the east that are coming, and you're probably going to have a similar army, and maybe even more than that. You could have conceivably about a half a billion men down there, that God is just going to draw all these armies down there, and it's going to be the end of the world. And when they're fighting it out down there tooth and nail against each other, then Christ is going to literally, physically return just at the very end of the world. And then we are told in Revelation that these armies are going to turn their guns on Christ, and he's just going to speak the word and just expunge every last drop of blood out of their veins, and it's going to form a river of blood for 200 miles of the height of a horse's bridle. I mean, this carnage is just going to be incredible. I mean, it just defies all imagination. But that's what he's talking about, like that verse 2 in chapter 34 of Isaiah, for the Lord's indignation is against all the nations, and his wrath against all their armies. He has utterly destroyed them. He has given them over to slaughter, so their slain will be thrown out, and their corpses will give off a stench, their stench, and the mountains will be drenched with their blood. Now, that's, you just tie that in with what I said about Revelation, how Christ is going to expunge every last drop of blood out of them. Well, it says here, their corpses will give off a stench, and the mountains will be drenched with their blood. Well, that's what's going to happen there when he comes back and destroys these armies. And then he's going to give over all their corpses to the vultures and to, you know, basically the birds of the sky. Because on that chapter 19 of Revelations that I just read from, it's right after I read about Christ returning on a white horse and having the name written on him, King of Kings and Lord of Lords. It goes on to say in Revelation 19, and then verse 17, then I saw an angel standing in the sun, and he cried out with a loud voice, saying to all the birds which fly in mid-heaven, come and assemble for the great supper of God, so that you may eat the flesh of kings and the flesh of commanders and the flesh of mighty men and the flesh of horses and those who sit on them and the flesh of all men, both free men and slaves and small and great. And I saw the beast and the kings of the earth and the armies assembled to make war against him who sat upon the horse and against his army. Now, what he's saying here is John said he saw an angel standing in the sun, which suggests to me, since the sun is 93 million miles from the earth, it suggests to me that this angel is calling birds from great distances. In other words, from all over the world, these birds are coming and they're going to just feast and devour these corpses of these men that Christ has slain with that two-edged sword that comes out of his mouth. In other words, with just a word, he destroys these armies down there that are all congregated down there in this battle of Armageddon. That's what he's talking about here in that verse 3 of Isaiah chapter 34. So their slain will be thrown out, their corpses will give off their stench, and the mountains will be drenched with their blood. And then he goes on to say, and all the hosts of heaven will wear away, and the sky will be rolled up like a scroll, and all their hosts will also wither away as a leaf withers from the vine, or as one withers from a fig tree. Now, this is one thing that you constantly see with the prophets, constantly. I don't care whether they're minor prophets or major prophets, is that nothing is in chronological order. They will constantly oscillate between a near judgment and a far judgment, between the first coming of Christ and the second coming of Christ, between the end of the world or a coming judgment upon Israel in the near future. But in this verse 4, when he talks about all the hosts of heaven will wear away and the sky will be rolled up like a scroll, well, John says that he saw the sky roll back like a scroll when Jesus Christ is returning. And in other words, it rolls back and you see Christ coming with all the armies of heaven. But this here, when it says all the hosts of heaven will wear away, well, the hosts of heaven here is referring to the stars and the galaxies and the planets in the heavens. And we are told in the Psalms that this same thing, that there's going to come a time, and this particular time will be basically at the very end of the millennial period. That will be when God is just going to roll up this universe like a used garment. That's what we're told in Psalms, and that's what we're told right here. And in Revelations, we are told that when Christ sets up this great white throne for the judgment of the damned, he says he saw heaven and earth, and they fled from the face of him who sat upon the throne. I mean, that is really, really mind-boggling when you look out there in space and you look at all the hundreds of millions, and there's billions of stars. They say there's 100 billion stars in our galaxy. There's something like 100 billion galaxies in our universe. Now, they can't even see the end of it. So, in other words, what I'm saying is there's literally just billions upon billions and billions of stars out there. But the Bible says that this whole universe is going to flee from the face of him who sits upon his throne. And he's going to do away with this universe. And then he's going to make a new heavens and a new earth. All right? So, that's what this is really referring to here. You see how he jumps from the end of the world or the second coming of Christ or the millennial period, and now this is the, you know, he's referring to here just before the eternal state. And then he says here in that verse 5, he says, "For my sword is sated in heaven. Behold, that it shall descend for judgment upon Edom and upon the people whom I have devoted to destruction. The sword of the Lord is filled with blood. It is sated with fat, with the blood of lambs and goats, with the fat of kidneys of rams, for the Lord has a sacrifice in Bozrah and a great slaughter in the land of Edom. Wild oxen will also fall with them, and young bulls with strong ones. Thus their land will be soaked with blood, and their dust will become greasy with fat. For the Lord has a day of vengeance, a day of recompense for the cause of Zion. Its streams will be turned into pitch, and its loose earth into brimstone, and its land will become burning pitch. It will not be quenched day or night. Its smoke will go up forever from generation to generation. It will be desolate. None will pass through it forever and ever." Now, before we go any further, this is talking about when Christ returns. It gives you some pretty interesting details, because when Christ does return to this world, what direction is he coming from? What's that?
East.
Yeah, we are told that in Matthew 24. You know, Jesus basically said, Matthew 24, 27, he said, "For just as lightning comes from the east and flashes even to the west, so will be the coming of the Son of Man." And then he also said, right after that, "Wherever the corpse is, the vultures will gather." And I just mentioned how the vultures are going to gather there. But Christ is actually coming from the east. But what's very interesting about the way he's coming from the east is when you read this, what it's saying here is he's actually going to go over the land of Edom. If you can see it on this map here, this is Edom right in here. That's Bozrah right there. There's Petra right there. This is all known as the Mount Seir area. This has been known as the land of Edom. Edom is where Esau had settled. And now, who's Esau in the Bible?
Brother Jacob.
He's Jacob's brother, and he was the one that sold his birthright for a mess of porridge. And matter of fact, we are told very clearly in Hebrews chapter 12. Hebrews chapter 12 says this. It says, "See to it that no one comes short of the grace of God, that no root of bitterness springing up causes trouble, and by it many be defiled, and there be no immoral or godless person like Esau, who sold his own birthright for a single meal. For you know that even afterwards, when he desired to inherit the blessing, he was rejected, for he found no place for repentance, though he sought it with tears." And what's interesting about this is, of course, we don't have time to do this, but when I went through the book of Obadiah, it's only one chapter in the Minor Prophets in the Old Testament, but it deals specifically about the judgment that God has for Edom, or the Edomites. And now the Edomites, they settled in that Mount Seir area. And for centuries, that whole area right in there, it was just basically overgrown with nettles and thorns and thistles and just the encroachment of the wilderness, because what happened there is that God judged the Edomites there, because these Edomites, they were brothers to the Jews, to the Israelites, but they treated them with utter contempt. And so God had a special judgment for them. Now, there's not an Edomite left on the face of the earth today, because God predicted their destruction. He predicted their destruction through a number of the prophets. Because here's the thing, when it comes to Edomites, we have a lot of modern-day Edomites in the church today. Even though the Edomites have been long wiped off the face of the map, there are still a lot of them in the spiritual sense. And these are people who lay claim to being God's people. Because who was Esau's grandfather?
Abraham.
Abraham. right? So he could make a legitimate claim to being God's people. Only Esau sold his birthright for a mess of porridge, and we are told that see to it that no one falls short of the glory of God or the honor of God by selling out their birthright by being what? By being immoral or godless, right? People can be in the church and yet be living immoral lives or godless lives, and they are modern day Edomites. They're not born again. They're not saved. But they're in the church, and very often they are in the face of God's true people. You see this constantly. It just goes on continuously. Well, God has a special judgment for these people. But what's interesting, 3.5 years into the tribulation period, you're going to see a situation where the Antichrist is going to go into this rebuilt temple down there in Jerusalem, and then he's going to claim himself to be God. Now, this is what's interesting about what John says in the book of Revelation, chapter 12. He talked about this sign of a woman. He said this, "And a great sign appeared in the heavens, a woman clothed with the sun and the moon under her feet, and on her head were a crown of 12 stars, and she was with child, and she cried out, being in labor and pain to give birth." Now, when we went through the book of Revelation, I explained all this, that this woman is really Israel. All right, these 12 stars signified basically the 12 tribes of Israel. And it says here that another sign appeared in the heavens, and behold, a great dragon having 7 heads and 10 horns, and on his head were 7 diadems. And his tail swept away a third of the stars of heaven, and he threw them to the earth. And the dragon stood before the woman who was about to give birth, so that when she gave birth, he might devour the child. Now, this is Israel, and the child is obviously Jesus Christ. And it goes on to say, "And she gave birth to a son, a male child, who is to rule all the nations with a rod of iron. And her child was caught up to God and to his throne." Now listen to this. "Then the woman fled into the wilderness, where she had a place prepared by God, so that there she would be nourished for 1,260 days. In other words, for 3.5 years. And then it goes on to basically say that what's going to happen there is that once the Antichrist goes into that temple 3.5 years into the tribulation period, he will declare himself to be God, and then he will turn on the Jews. It appears that a lot of the Jews, they try to escape. They go south. They go down to this area right in here in Edom, and a lot of them try to take refuge in some of these places called like Petra, which was basically one of the capital cities down there in Mount Seir area. There, a lot of the Jews are going to, you know, basically go down there to hide from the Antichrist. But they're also going to be pursued by armies. And so when Christ comes back, this is my take on it. This is what I perceive after reading all of these things and putting them together, is that Christ is coming from the east, but instead of going directly to Jerusalem, he appears to go almost like to Mount Sinai, and then makes a beeline north, and he goes over Edom, he goes over Petra, he goes over Bozrah, he goes over this whole land, and then he goes directly to Jerusalem. Now, what does that suggest to us? If Christ, when he comes back, he appears to be coming from Mount Sinai. What's significant about Mount Sinai?
That's where the law was given.
That's where the law was given. So in other words, what does that say to us spiritually if Jesus Christ is coming from Mount Sinai, going straight over Bozrah?
Judged by the law.
He's coming from the law, perspective of law. In other words, we're not saved by keeping the law. We're saved by grace, okay, through faith in Jesus Christ. All right, because none of us are able to keep the law the way it's required to be kept. So when anybody who rejects Jesus Christ, guess what? Now they're going to come under the judgment of the law because they didn't throw themselves upon the mercy of the blood of Jesus Christ. So now he's coming from that direction. He's coming from Mount Sinai. He's going to go right over that Mount Edom area. And this is what he's talking about here. When you read this again, he says in that verse 5, "For my sword is sated in heaven." When he comes back, he's got this two-edged sword that comes out of his mouth. But this is what he had determined in heaven. And when he comes back, he's going to destroy these armies down there. And he's going to destroy a lot of these armies. I guess there are a number of people who are going to be just on the brink of overrunning the Jewish people down there who are hiding down there in that Mount Seir area, in that Edom area. And he's going to come back and rescue them. For because he says in that verse 5, For my sword is sated in heaven. Behold, it shall descend for judgment upon Edom and upon the people whom I have devoted to destruction. These people just fall into that category, which Paul predicted what they would be like in the last days. In 2 Timothy chapter 3, he said, "But realize this, that in the last days difficult times will come, for men will be lovers of self and lovers of money, and boastful and arrogant and revilers and disobedient to parents and ungrateful and unholy, unloving, irreconcilable, malicious gossips without self-control and brutal and haters of good and treacherous and reckless and conceited, lovers of pleasure rather than lovers of God and holding to a form of godliness, although they have denied his power. Avoid such men as these." And he just went on to say, too, Paul says right after that, he says that these type of people, they're always learning but never able to come to the knowledge of the truth. In other words, these are the modern-day Edomites who are basically, they claim to be spiritual, all right? But they're the ones who basically are at war with God's people, and God's going to judge them. And so that's what he's talking about here. In that verse 6 in chapter 34 of Isaiah, it says, "The sword of the Lord is filled with blood. It is sated with fat, with the blood of lambs and goats, and with the fat of kidney rams. For the Lord has a sacrifice in Bozrah, and a great slaughter in the land of Edom. Wild oxen will also fall with them, and young bulls with strong ones." What are wild oxen and young bulls? What's he referring to there? You don't take it literally, take it spiritually what it means. Because remember in Psalm 22, when it talked about Jesus Christ's death, it said, "Be not far from me, for trouble is near, for there is none to help. Many bulls have surrounded me, strong bulls of Bashan have encircled me. They open wide their mouth at me as a raving and roaring lion. I am poured out like water, and all my bones are out of joint. My heart is like wax, it is melted within me. My strength is dried up like a potsherd, and my tongue cleaves to my jaws. And you laid me in the dust of death, for dogs have surrounded me, and a band of evildoers has encompassed me. They pierce my hands and my feet. I can count all of my bones, and they look and they stare at me, and they divide my garments among them, and for my clothing they cast lots." And this was a prediction that was made almost 900 years before Christ came on the scene. But he basically said to Herod that he was surrounded by strong bulls of Bashan, and he was surrounded by dogs. Well, Jesus Christ, when he's hanging on that cross, wasn't surrounded by literal bulls or literal dogs, but this is the symbolism of these people being very powerful, very influential, you know. And Jesus said, "Don't give what is holy to dogs, because it is just going to turn on you." And these bulls of Bashan, they were basically the scribes, the Pharisees, the Sadducees, the religious leaders, the powers that be during Jesus Christ's day when they were at the foot of his cross. That's what it's talking about here. So when you jump back over to Isaiah 34 in that verse 7 where it says, "Wild oxen will also fall with them, and young bulls with strong ones. Their land will be soaked with blood, and their dust will become greasy with fat. For the Lord has a day of vengeance, a year of recompense for the cause of Zion." You know, this is what's going to happen at the very end when he destroys these armies down there. But now look at this verse 9. And this is kind of significant because it says, "Its streams will be turned into pitch, and its loose earth into brimstone, and its land will become a burning pitch." Now he's talking about Edom here. But what's interesting to me, what is pitch?
Tar.
This is a definition from the dictionary. It says, "Any of various thick, dark, sticky substances obtained from the distillation's residue of coal, tar, or petroleum, any various bitumen, which are naturally flammable mixtures." And he also says this, that land will become a burning pitch, and he says here, "And it's loose earth into brimstone." What's brimstone?
It's sulfur,
but you look it up in the dictionary and you read that sulfur is used in gunpowder and in matches. And all I'm saying is this. Now, remember that menace that was just, he's been long dead, thank God, is that Saddam Hussein during the Gulf War, which was over 20 years ago, when he invaded Kuwait. Well, when he ran out of Kuwait, what did he do? He set on fire all their oil wells. Right? And he poured all this oil into the Persian Gulf and he set it on fire. And that was like burning pitch, the whole thing. Those things just burned for weeks and weeks and weeks, and they had to use dynamite to blow each one of those out. So you get a situation where what I see is at the very end of the world, when you've got all of these armies down there trying to get some resources down there, either the potash from the Dead Sea, or more than likely get control of all the oil fields or whatever. But in man's absolute insanity, I think he's going to start setting a lot of the oil wells on fire. And when you read this in that verse 9, its streams will be turned into pitch, okay, almost like burning oil. And it's loose earth into brimstone. That's burning pitch, you know what I'm saying? So just apply it to the end of the world. Now, it says this, it will not be quenched day or night. Its smoke will go up forever from generation to generation. It will be desolate. None will pass through it forever, ever. But pelican and hedgehog will possess it. Now owl and raven will dwell in it, and he will stretch over it a line of desolation and the plumb line of emptiness. Its nobles, there is no one there. Whom they may proclaim king, and all his princes will be nothing. Thorns will come up in its fortified towers, nettles and thistles in its fortified cities. It will also be a haunt of jackals and an abode of ostriches. The desert creatures will meet with the wolves, and the hairy goat will also cry out to its kind. Yes, the night monster will settle there and will find herself a resting place. The tree snake will make its nest and lay its eggs there, and it will hatch and gather them under its protection. Yes, the hawks will be gathered there, everyone with his kind. Now, he's talking about Edom here. And you've got to be able to discern exactly what he's saying. Because if you look at that verse 10, it says, it will not be quenched day or night. Its smoke will go up forever from generation to generation. It will be desolate. None will pass through it forever and ever. Now, he's talking about this land of Edom. But you've got to put everything, I think, in its context. Because actually, in Isaiah 66, what's interesting to me is when Christ comes back and sets up his millennial kingdom, did you know that there's actually, when people go to Jerusalem to worship the Lord, that they also can go down apparently to Edom, and there's a place there where you'll actually be able to see people in hell? I know it's pretty hard to believe, but this is what it says in Isaiah chapter 66. It says this in verses 23 and 24, and it shall be from new moon to new moon, and from Sabbath to Sabbath, all mankind will come to bow down before me, says the Lord. Now listen to this. Then they will go forth and look on the corpses of men who have transgressed against me. For their worm will not die, and their fire will not be quenched, and they will be an abhorrence to all mankind. Now, I hope I'm not reading too much into this, but the way I see it is that you get a situation where Christ is ruling and reigning, and the devil's been bound in hell with all of his henchmen, that there's total peace and tranquility upon the earth. I mean, everything is conducive to life and happiness and joy and longevity and everything else. And God also allows men to see the end results of people who revolt against him. And that's what I just read here. And it was Jesus who said this in Mark chapter 9. He said this, whoever causes one of these little ones who believes in me to stumble, it would be better for him if he were to have a heavy millstone hung around his neck and he had been cast into the sea. If your hand causes you to stumble, cut it off. It is better for you to go into life crippled than having two hands to go into hell, into unquenchable fire, where their worm does not die and their fire is not quenched. If your foot causes you to stumble, cut it off. It is better for you to enter life lame than having your two feet to be cast into hell, where the worm does not die and the fire is not quenched. And if your eye causes you to stumble, throw it out. It is better for you to enter the kingdom of God with one eye than having two eyes to be cast into hell, where their worm does not die and their fire is not quenched. Now, three times he said that hell is a situation where the worm does not die and the fire is not quenched. And you look over here when he's talking about in that verse 10 of Isaiah chapter 34, it will not be quenched day or night. Its smoke will go up forever from generation to generation. It will be desolate. So when he's talking about here, the smoke will go up forever, well, take that spiritually. I really do believe that's spiritual. Because it was in chapter 14 of Revelation, it says, then another angel, a third one, followed them, saying with a loud voice, if anyone worships a beast in his image and receives a mark on his forehead or on his hand, he will also drink of the wine of the wrath of God, which is mixed in full strength in the cup of his anger, and he will be tormented with fire and brimstone in the presence of the angels and in the presence of the Lamb. Now listen to this, and the smoke of their torment goes up forever and ever, and they have no rest day or night, those who worship the beast in his image, and whoever receives the mark of his name. So it says the smoke of their torment goes up forever and ever. When you go over here, it says the smoke will go up forever. I believe that this is talking about spiritually, that this judgment that God is pronouncing upon Edom or the Edomites will go up forever and ever, just like we read there in Revelation. And then it talks about the pelican and the hedgehog. It talks about the raven. It talks about, you know, these various animals that will inherit Edom. Well, that's what happened once the Edomites had, you know, died out. Now, what's interesting to me is that who's the last Edomite that we read about in the Bible? King Herod the Great, we are told that he is from Edomia, and Edomia is the Greek name for Edom. And Herod the Great, his son was Herod Antipas. That same Herod Antipas is the one that Jesus called a fox. He's the one that had John the Baptist beheaded, and he's the one who Jesus Christ stood before, and Herod just mocked him and put a purple robe on him. That's the last time that we ever read about an Edomite. Because what happened to the Edomites, basically, is that the Babylonians really, really turned on them. Now, these people were just impregnable in their fortresses up there in Mount Seir. But what happened was that when the Babylonians came down to destroy the southern tribe of Israel, to destroy Judah, they made a pact with the Edomites. And the Edomites were basically to cut off any of the God's people or the Jewish people fleeing from Judah. And they cut them off. But here's what the Babylonians did, and you read it in Obadiah, is that they told the Edomites, they said, listen, we'll meet you at the border and we'll divide up the spoils. But what the Babylonians did is they turned on their army, because the Babylonians knew that there's no way that we could attack the Edomites in their fortresses because they were so well fortified. Did you see some of these pictures here? Some of the passageways back into their cities, it was so narrow that you could only pass through one person at a time or one horse at a time, meaning this, that it was just impregnable. They could defend it so easily. But the Babylonians tricked them, and they said, come on, meet us at the forts and we'll divide up the spoils. And then when they were down there, the Babylonian army turned upon the Edomite army, and they basically wiped out their army. But the Edomites themselves were not totally wiped out, but that really was the beginning of their demise, because then the trade routes eventually changed, and basically the people just left their places of where they used to live in their cities, and then they became overgrown with all these desert creatures. But also this applies spiritually too, because you can even read it here where it says here in that verse 14, the desert creatures will meet with the wolves, and the hairy goat will also cry to its kind. Yes, the night monster will settle there, and will find herself a resting place. Now, does anybody's Bible say something different than the night monster? Anybody say the demon goat? Well, anyway, all I'm saying is this, is that all of these animals and all these birds are unclean. Now, we know that, like even in the book of Revelation, where it talks about this city of Babylon, he said it's filled with every kind of hateful and unclean bird. Talking spiritually speaking now, all right? Because you go back into Leviticus, I think it's chapter 11, God gives all the dietary laws of what you could eat, what you couldn't eat, what was clean and unclean. And he listed all these different animals that you couldn't eat, but they have a spiritual significance to them. That's why when he's talking about all these creatures here, all these creatures began to just basically dwell in the cities of Edom, all right? But they also have a spiritual application when it talks about the Edomites being destroyed spiritually. Now, it's interesting. I mean, if you go back into even Ezekiel, I don't have time to get into that, but in Ezekiel, there's actually a who's who in hell in the chapter 32 of Ezekiel. I won't read the whole thing, but he's talking about here how there's various nations in hell, and he talks about the Assyrians having a place there in hell and these other nations. Well, even Jesus, when he talked about Capernaum, he said, do you think you're going to be exalted to heaven? You're going to be brought down to hell. So, yeah, there's nations and there's cities in hell, but understand this, not everybody in every nation or like every Assyrian is in hell, or everybody from Capernaum is in hell, but as a whole, their populations are down there because they rejected God, they're at war with God or whatever. Well, this is going to be the same situation with the Edomites. Now, just winding this chapter down, these last two verses, it says in this verse 16, seek from the book of the Lord and read. Not one of these will be missing. None will lack its mate, for his mouth has commanded and his spirit has gathered them. He has cast a lot for them, and his hand has divided it to them by lying. They shall possess it forever from generation to generation. They will dwell in it. Now, that verse 16, what is it saying?
It means when the question is asked, did God really say? The answer is yes.
Yeah, yeah. You could take this to the bank. Look at that verse 16. Seek from the book of the Lord and read. Now, I got news for you. This book is God's word. And you can rest assured, you could take it to the bank. God said what he meant and meant what he said. And people today, they scoff at the Bible. Even people within the church, pastors, ministers, priests, theologians, lay people, they mock the Bible. They say, well, you know, God didn't create the world in 6 days. It's billions and billions of years old. And then they go on and on and on about all this baloney about evolution. I guarantee you, I bet my life on it. God meant what he said what he meant. There's no doubt in my mind. So when he says this, seek from the book of the Lord and read. Not one of these will be missing. None will lack its mate, for his mouth has commanded and his spirit has gathered it. Now, he's talking specifically about verse 17. He cast the lot for them. His hand has divided it to them. By lying, they shall possess it forever from generation to generation. They will dwell in it. He's talking about here all these unclean animals. He has allotted them. He has assigned them. In other words, it says that he cast lot for them. That's what happened when Joshua went into the land of Cana with all of his people. They cast lot to determine what tribe would get what territory, and then what family, what clan would get what property. All right. Well, here the lot is cast in terms of all these unclean animals and these birds that are going to be allotted a portion up there in Edom. All right, but then when it talks about they will possess it forever and ever, you can rest assured that that's referring to the fact that this is also spiritual. You could take it literally, but also spiritually, because when it talks about forever and ever, here's the thing. This earth and this heavens, this present earth and this present heavens are going to be done away with. And then there's going to be a new heavens and a new earth where you're not going to have a land of Edom or any of these other things. But there will be a place in hell for the Edomites. These are the ones who are always at war with God and God's people. These are the ones who, like Esau, sell out their birthright for a mess of porridge. You see what's talking about there? Anybody have anything you want to add or share? All right, I want to read this chapter 35 of Isaiah. Chapter 35, it only is 10 verses. And you tell me what this is talking about now, because like I said, these prophets, they do this all the time. They jump from one period of time to another. They just oscillate back and forth, near judgment, far judgment. They talk about a near event, or they talk about the second coming of Christ, or they talk about the end of the world, or they talk about his millennial reign, and then sometimes they even talking about the eternal kingdom. But here in this chapter 35 of Isaiah, it says this: the wilderness and the desert will be glad, and the arapa will rejoice and blossom like the crocus. It will blossom profusely and rejoice with rejoicing and shout of joy. The glory of Lebanon will be given to it, the majesty of Carmel and Sharon. They will see the glory of the Lord, the majesty of our God. Now, what period of time is he talking about here in that verses 1 and 2?
I would say millennium.
This is the millennium. It says the wilderness and the desert will be glad. The arapa will rejoice and blossom. The arapa is the desert area, you know, around there by the Dead Sea and the Negev. That's what we refer to as the desert or the arapa. But it says here, that's going to, when Christ comes back, that's going to blossom, right? And he says, like the crocus. What's a crocus?
Flower.
It's just a large spring blooming plant of the iris family, and it's basically it's a flower that it could be white or yellow or purple. Usually has three petals to it, but what it's talking about here is that it's going to blossom. This desert area is going to look plush with foliage and with trees and with plants and with flowers. And then it says here, it will blossom profusely and rejoice with rejoicing and a shout of joy, and the glory of Lebanon will be given to it. And Lebanon, that was up north. That was where they had their cedar trees, which like our redwoods. And it's going to be like that down in the desert. And it says the majesty of Carmel and Sharon. Now, Carmel was that mountain by the sea. All right, and also Sharon, it was noted for its pools and its meadows. I mean, it's like almost comparing places to our Yosemite as far as its grandeur, how majestic it is. And it says here, and they will see the glory of the Lord, the majesty of our God. So it's talking about when Christ is ruling and reigning. He was talking about almost all the way through this chapter 34 about the end of the world and the tremendous judgment. But here he's talking about why Christ is ruling and reigning. And then he says here in that verse 3, encourage the exhausted and strengthen the feeble. Say to those with anxious heart, take courage, fear not. Behold, your God will come with vengeance. The recompense of God will come and he will save you. Now that's interesting. Now he jumps back to what period of time?
The end of the world.
The end of the world. And now remember, at the very end of the world, in my opinion, there's going to be 3 days of darkness. I only say 3 days because that's the time frame that God sent 3 days of darkness upon Egypt. And you're going to see all these plagues that were sent upon Egypt. You're going to see these duplicated at the end of the world, only it's going to be on a global scale. And the prophets foretell that our sun is going to go out like a light bulb. Alright, now it's my opinion, it's only my opinion, there might be another explanation, but I really do feel like our sun is basically going to nova, it's going to cave in on itself, it's going to become as black as sackcloth, and it's going to last for about 3 days. Well, that's when no life is going to be spared on this planet. No life is going to be saved. That's why Jesus said in Matthew 24, he says, unless I come back and put an end to all this insanity, he says, no flesh is going to survive. But can you imagine at the last 3 days of the end of the world, when you see a situation when the whole world is staggering like a drunken man, everything, there's just massive earthquakes, it's just everything's coming down, where there's 100-pound hailstones just pulverizing the earth, where there's nuclear fires going off all over the earth, and the world is basically almost on fire, and the moon is like reflecting a blood red. You're going to see a situation where, man, people are just terrified. We're told that in Luke that men will be dying from heart attacks, from fear of the things that are happening all around him, and just when everything just seems totally, completely hopeless, then the heavens or the skies just roll back like a scroll, and you see Jesus Christ coming in great power and great glory, riding on a horse with the armies of heaven behind him. That's why it says this in that verse 3, encourage the exhausted and strengthen the feeble. All right, say to those with anxious heart, take courage, fear not, behold, your God will come with vengeance. Just hang on. Just hang on. He's coming. He's coming. The recompense of God will come, but he will save you. The people who have given their life to him during this terrible period of time, especially the Jews, when they see him coming. We are told that in Zechariah chapter 12, when they see him coming, they will weep over him as one weeps over an only son. And they will look upon him whom they have pierced, and they're going to really be remorseful. But you see a situation where people are just brought to the total brink of utter, complete destruction. And Jesus Christ comes back at the last second. So he's encouraging people to take courage, all right, to hold on, because God's coming with vengeance. And now, this is what's interesting to me. You tell me where this is quoted. This is verse 5. Then the eyes of the blind will be opened, and the ears of the deaf will be unstopped, and the lame will leap like a deer, and the tongue of the mute will shout for joy, for waters will break forth in the wilderness, and the streams in the Arabah. Now, who quoted this? Anybody remember?
Jesus quotes to the guy that John the Baptist sent to him.
Good. Well, you're close. In Matthew chapter 11, this is what it says. I think it's kind of interesting. It's when after John had been arrested. Now, John, when the first time that he saw Christ before Christ went into the wilderness for 40 days of fasting, what did John say when he saw Jesus coming? He said, behold the Lamb of God who takes away the sins of the world. And then he baptized Jesus, right? John basically pointed him out as being the Messiah. But now, John's languishing in prison. He's hearing all kinds of things about Jesus, but now he has doubts. Now he has fears. Now he has concerns, wondering, did I make a mistake here? Because I'm sure that John also thought that maybe Jesus Christ, even though he's going to take away the sins of the world, he may have thought very well, too, that he was coming in great power and great glory. I'm sure he had his doubts. But this is what it says in Matthew chapter 11. When Jesus had finished giving instructions to his 12 disciples, he departed from there to teach and preach in the cities. Now when John, while in prison, heard of the works of Christ, he sent word by his disciples and said to him, "Are you the expected one, or shall we look for someone else?" Now see, this is after he's in prison. He's having some second doubts. When before, he was sure. But now he's not sure because everything's going from bad to worse in his own life, right?
Oh, so even though he sees the Spirit of God descending on Jesus and he hears a voice from heaven, he's expecting big king that takes over all of...
Well, yeah. He must have had some misconceptions along the way, because put yourself in John's shoes. Now things are really going bad for him in his life. He's in prison, man. He's wasting away. And now he's wondering, well, gee, are you the one? Did I make a mistake here? I'm going to read it again. He said to him, "Are you the expectant one, or shall we look for someone else?" And Jesus answered and said to them, "Go and report to John what you hear and see. Quote, the blind receive sight, and the lame walk, and the lepers are cleansed, and the deaf hear, and the dead are raised up, and the poor have the gospel preached to them. And blessed is he who does not take offense at me." Now, that's what Jesus said. And then he basically goes on to give a tribute to John when he basically said this. What did you go out in the wilderness to see? A reed shaken by the wind? But what did you go out to see? A man dressed in soft clothing? Those who wear soft clothing are in king's palaces. But what did you go out to see? A prophet? Yes, I tell you, and one who is more than a prophet. This is the one about whom it is written, "Behold, I will send my messenger ahead of you, who will prepare your way before you. Truly I say to you, among those born of women, there has not arisen anyone greater than John the Baptist. Yet the one who is least in the kingdom of heaven will be greater than he." And all I'm saying is this: Jesus Christ, you know, really spoke highly of John the Baptist at the time when John the Baptist really was having some second thoughts and some doubts, right? But what's interesting to me, look at what Jesus Christ quotes to him. We're reading in this chapter 35, we're reading about the return of Christ when he sets up his millennial kingdom, and how the desert is just going to blossom and everything's going to be thriving in terms of life. And then he says here, he jumps in that verse 3 to the end of the world when he says this: "Encourage the exhausted, strengthen the feeble, say to those with anxious heart, take courage, fear not, behold, your God will come with vengeance." Now that might have been something that John the Baptist was thinking about, coming with vengeance, and the recompense of God will come, but he will save you. Now, Jesus Christ did not quote that 3 and 4, did he? I just read in Matthew chapter 11, this is what he quotes in this 5 and 6. "Then the eyes of the blind will be opened, and the ears of the deaf will be unstopped. Then the lame will leap like a deer, and the tongue of the mute will shout for joy. For waters will break forth in the wilderness, and the streams in the Araba." In other words, he only quoted verse 5 and part of verse 6. And he said, "Go tell this to John." So in other words, Jesus Christ was only fulfilling one part of this prophecy, his first coming. But then the second coming he also talked about in the 2 verses before that. And then the 2 verses before that he talked about his millennial reign. You see how these prophets are? That's why it takes a great deal of discernment, I think, a working knowledge of all the Bible, to be able to see what time frame, what's the timetable. It's always going back and forth. You could talk about the first coming of Christ and the second coming of Christ sometimes in back-to-back verses, or sometimes even in the same verse, and you got to be able to discern what he's talking about here. But it's interesting to me, first 2 verses he's talking about the millennial reign of Christ. The next 2 verses he's talking about the return of Christ. The next 2 verses he's talking about Christ's first coming. Yeah.
It just, an analogy popped in my head about, you know, God's trying to paint a picture here through his prophets, and what does an artist do? Painting a picture.
What?
He doesn't stick on one portion of the picture until that's off. No, he works all over.
Yeah.
You know, depending on the artist, he may work on one little area and go jump around here and there. But in the end, the picture is going to be completed.
Yeah. All right. You're right. It's just putting together a massive big puzzle. All right? And you just take one piece at a time, fitting it here, fitting it there. That's what he's doing. But interesting to me, like I said, look at how he jumps back and forth. In this chapter 35, it's only 10 verses. But like I said, first 2 verses talked about his millennial reign. Second 2 verses, 3 and 4, talks about his return. The next 2 verses, 5 and 6, talks about his first coming. when he did what? He opened the eyes of the blind, opened the ears of the deaf. Now, in verse 7, it says, the scorched land will become a pool, and the thirsty ground springs of water. In the haunt of jackals, its resting place, grass becomes reeds and rushes. A highway will be there, a roadway, and it will be called the highway of holiness. The unclean will not travel on it, but it will be for him who walks that way, and fools will not wander on it. No lion will be there, nor will any vicious beast go up on it. These will not be found there, but the redeemed will walk there, and the ransom of the Lord will return and come with joyful shouting to Zion, and everlasting joy upon their heads, and they will find gladness and joy, and sorrow and sighing will flee away. Now, look at that. Amazing, isn't it? Now, in that verse 7 through 10, what period of time is he talking about?
Thank heaven to me.
Well, no, this is his millennial reign. This is when he's ruling and reigning. And he says, in that verse 8, a highway will be there, a roadway, and it will be called the highway of holiness. And the unclean will not travel on it. And it will be for him who walks that way. And fools will not wander on it. And then it says, no lion will be there, or any vicious beast will go up there. And there will be not found there, the redeemed will walk there. And you remember when we went through Isaiah chapter 11? He talked about that time. He said this, the wolf will dwell with the lamb, and the leopard will lie down with the young goat, and the calf and the young lion, and the fatling together, and a little boy will lead them. Also the cow and the bear will graze, and the young will lie down together, and the lion will eat straw like an ox, and the nursing child will play by the hole of the cobra, and the weaned child will put his hand on a viper's den, and they will not hurt or destroy in all of my holy mountain, for the earth will be full of the knowledge of the Lord as the waters cover the sea. In that day the nations will resort to the root of Jesse, who will stand as a signal for the people, and his resting place will be glorious. Now that was talked about in Isaiah chapter 11. It talked about Christ's millennial reign. And also, if you jump all the way back to chapter 65 of Isaiah, he talks about this same time when it says, behold, I will create new heavens and a new earth. He says, the former things will not be remembered or come to mind, but be glad and rejoice forever in what I create. For behold, I create Jerusalem for rejoicing and her people for gladness. And I also rejoice in Jerusalem and be glad in my people. And there will no longer be heard in her the voice of weeping and the sound of crying. And no longer will there be an infant who lives but a few days, or an old man who does not live out his days. For the youth will die at an age of 100, and the one who does not reach the age of 100 will be thought a curse. And they will build houses and inhabit them. And they will also plant vineyards and eat their fruit. And they will not build in another inhabit, and he will not plant and another eat. For as a lifetime of a tree, so shall be the days of my people, and my chosen ones will wear out the work of their hands, and they will not labor in vain, nor bear children for calamity. For they are the offsprings of those blessed of the Lord, and their descendants with them. And it will also come about that before I call, I will answer, and while they are still speaking, I will hear. And the wolf and the lamb will graze together, and the lion will eat straw like an ox, and the dust will be a serpent's food, and they will do no evil or harm on all my holy mountains, says the Lord. Now, you see what I'm saying? This chapter 35, it just jumped all over the place, didn't it? It just jumped all over the place in terms of its timetable in regards to, you know, the second coming of Christ and the first coming of Christ and or the ruling and reigning of Christ. That's what he's referring to here in this chapter 35. Does anybody have anything you want to add or share to what we just read here?
Well, why does it say no lion will be there, but then it says the lion will be...
Well, what he's talking about is no lion in terms of no threatening, you know, beast will be there. The lion will eat straw like an ox. But also, too, Satan is referred to as a lion. He's like a roaring lion that seeks who he can devour, right? I mean, it has a spiritual context to it, too. But also, understand something. The millennial period is different from the eternal kingdom or the eternal state. The millennial period is a 1,000-year reign of Christ. And I just read it here in Isaiah. There will be a limited amount of death because here's the thing. The people who survive the 7-year tribulation, this horrible time, and they give their life to Christ, when Christ returns, he's going to send his angels throughout all the world, and they're going to gather up all the survivors, whether they're saved or they're lost, and they're going down into Jerusalem, and Jesus is going to separate the saved from the lost by the, you know, separating the sheep from the goats. And he, on the basis of, hey, I was hungry, I was thirsty, I was sick, I was naked and in a prison, and what do you do for me? And then he's going to slay the goats on his left, and their souls are going to go into hell. And then that's when we are told in Zephaniah chapter 1 that God is basically going to have to remove all things from the earth and recreate it. And then all those people who are on the right the sheep, they're going to go into the millennial kingdom, but they're going into this kingdom with their fallen natures. In other words, they don't have resurrected bodies. And so now they're going to repopulate the earth. And it's going to be a situation where there's going to be a limited amount of death, because I just read it here in Isaiah that if somebody doesn't live to be 100 years old, they're going to be figured to be accursed of God. In other words, at 100, you're going to be seen like you're a teenager. Right? Everything's going to be kind of revert back to the way it was at the very beginning. But there will be a limited amount of death. For example, if during the millennial period, let's just say somebody defies God's laws and he starts living in adultery or doing any number of things, well, his life's going to be cut short and he's going to be considered to be accursed of God. But as a whole, most people are going to live for hundreds of years. All right, but down during a 1,000-year reign now, the world's going to be not just repopulated. In my opinion, you could have, if let's just say, for example, 1 million people go into this new kingdom. All right, now that's not too far a stretch. Consider that there's almost 8 billion people on the planet now, and Isaiah chapter 13 says that God's going to make men scarcer than pure gold. Let's just say there's 1 million people. There might be more, there might be a few hundred thousand, whatever. Well, how long do you think it would take to really have a population explosion where everything is conducive to life and longevity and happiness and procreation? I would say this. I would venture to say this. Probably inside of 1,000 years, if you started out with 1 million people, you could probably easily have between 70 to 100 billion people on the face of this planet. All right? But what's going to happen at the very, very end of this 1,000-year reign?
It'll be an uprising.
Believe it or not, God's going to know that there's a lot of people during this millennial kingdom who were basically born into this kingdom and never have known anything like we've known today, in terms of, you know, heartbreak and disillusionment and pain and suffering and sorrow and dying and grief. These people born in, they're not going to know any of this type of stuff. And a lot of them are going to begin to resent Christ and his laws and his ordinances. And the devil's therefore is going to be released out of his prison for a short period of time. And he's going to be able to go forth over the entire world. And he's going to go directly to Gog and Magog, which is what?
Russian people.
It's the Russian people. And he's going to stir up another social revolution, believe it or not. And he's going to stir up everybody whose hearts are not right with God. He's going to stir them up, and they're going to march on Jerusalem. And John says that their numbers are so vast that they're like the sands of the seashore. But when they surround the city of Jerusalem to attack Christ and his people, their war doesn't even get off the ground, because it says that fire comes down from heaven and consumes them. And it's possible, I mean, this is speculative on my part, I hope I'm not making too much of a mental stretch here, but it's possible that more people can die during the millennial period than all the other dispensations combined, if you've got like 100 billion people on this planet, or 70 billion people. Now, that's truly mind-boggling to me, and most people would never even believe it. But if you put all these pieces together of this big, huge puzzle, and all these prophecies together, you can see where this is headed. And then right after that fire comes down from heaven and consumes those rebels, what's going to happen?
Judgment.
Huh?
The judgment?
Yeah. Then the great white throne is set up, and we are told that the sea and the earth give up the dead bodies that are in them, the graves. And the souls in hell come out, and they're reunited with their bodies, they're resurrected, and then they stand before this great white throne. And then it says that heaven and earth flee from the face of him who sits upon the throne. It just disappears, right? And then there's this great white throne judgment, and there's no saved in this judgment. And then all these damned souls are going to be thrown into the lake of fire, along with death and hell, or Hades. And then there's going to be the new heavens and new earth, where the city of Jerusalem that John describes is 1,500 miles wide, 1,500 miles long,
okay,
and 1,500 miles.
Okay, that's what you're confusing me about.
Okay, that's
new heaven,
that's
earth, and then the new heaven and new earth. I'm confused.
Understand something, and that's why he was even mentioning there, new heavens and new earth. That's why I'm saying it. Always, you got to be able to discern the new heavens and new earth. That's the eternal kingdom. Okay,
so he cleaned up the old one.
Cleaned up the old one, but he's going to create an entire new one.
That's why I was confused.
Okay, yes, because like I'm saying, sometimes you could read this in the same chapter, same basically verses back to back that will deal with one, you know, dispensation or another, a one time frame or another. But that eternal kingdom, there's going to be absolutely no death, no dying. It's going to be a new heavens, new earth, and then this city, this of Jerusalem, is going to come down on earth. And there's not going to be any temple. Why?
Christ is the temple.
God is going to be dwelling with man.
Okay.